Peter, it's a great surprise as you're reading through the New Testament to find that after Jesus has left the scene, another character should be introduced. You wouldn't expect the story to be written like that. And this other character that's introduced that plays a leading part really plays a quite dominant part in the New Testament. He writes more than half the books of the New Testament. And the story of the developing church is mainly about him. The Acts of the Apostles turn out to be almost the Acts of Paul, because he dominates half the book of the story of the church that he contained in the New Testament. He becomes a dominant figure in the thought of Christianity, such that people quote him as much, if not more, than they quote Jesus. And what is even more surprising is that he wasn't one of the 12 apostles to start with. He really, as far as we know, didn't have anything to do with Jesus while Jesus was alive. If he did have anything to do with him, he would be in opposition to him. But we do not know that he ever saw Jesus or had contact with him. And he certainly wasn't one of the followers, and he certainly wasn't one of the chosen 12 followers of Jesus. And yet he comes to dominate the pages of the New Testament and the understanding of Christianity. And Paul is an interesting man because he is like a lens. He focuses the issues of Christianity with great precision, so much precision that people don't like him, actually, because after you've dealt with Paul, you understand Christianity with such clarity that you either hate it or love it. And Paul himself does that. He is of the very essence of Christianity, is Paul. And, not surprisingly, he is greatly disliked in our community. He's seen as a perverter of the gospel, the simple gospel that Jesus taught. In the next 2 weeks, we'll be looking at Paul and the attacks that were levelled against him in his own day, because the same things that are said of him today were said of him 2,000 years ago or near enough. And we'll be looking at Paul, whether he was a purveyor of the gospel, whether he was one who just went around the countryside selling the gospel for money. That's how he made his living. Was it a good living for him? That was the attack that was levelled against him in the week before the mid-session break. We'll be looking at Paul, the perverter of the gospel, to see the nature of the attack that's levelled against him as a twister and distorter of the simple message of Christianity. But today we look at the subject of Paul, the convert, and we're doing this 3-week series because we've been examining one of Paul's writings, that is the second epistle he wrote, the second letter he wrote to the Corinthian church. And to understand that letter, you've got to understand the man, just as much as to understand the man, you've got to understand that letter. So we're taking 3 weeks off in the course of looking at that particular letter to look at Paul, the convert, today, and then the purveyor of the gospel, and then the perverter of the gospel. But I suggest to you that looking at Paul the convert is a marvellous thing because you actually see in him the very essence of Christianity. But when you understand Paul and his conversion, you'll understand Christianity with a clarity that is quite disarming. It really will change the very nature of your acceptance and understanding of Christianity. See, when you understand Paul properly, keep changing Saul to Paul because he changes his name to himself, right? So I'm saying Saul, I'm meaning Paul, and I'm saying Paul, I mean Saul. But when you understand him properly and his conversion, you see that good people, according to Christianity, go to hell, and that the only people who ever go to heaven are bad people. Now, that is not what most people think about Christianity, but when you grasp Saul correctly, you see that that is fundamentally what Christianity is about. And that is a first basic Christianity. If you didn't understand that thing of Christianity and you think you're a Christian, let me tell you something about life. You're not a Christian because you don't understand the first thing about it. And if you rejected Christianity but you didn't know that good people go to hell and the only people who ever go to heaven are bad people, then what you have rejected is not Christianity either, because you obviously don't know the first thing about it, seeing that very basic first thing about Christianity is the good go down and the bad go up, if you put them in those spatial kind of terms. Now, there are people here who are so committed to their own misunderstanding of Christianity and so charitable and kind and big-hearted of nature that they think I've actually made a slip of the tongue about 3 times in a row. And they think I meant to say that the good go to heaven and the bad go to hell, but I haven't made a slip of the tongue 3 times in a row. I meant what I was saying. And what I'm suggesting to you is you don't understand the first thing about Christianity, but I'm glad you're here. Because Saul become Paul, the convert who was so reluctant, and reluctant he was, actually will demonstrate to you, and you can just keep listening on to it, he will demonstrate to you 1,000 years later that the basis of Christianity is about the fact that the good go to hell and the only people who ever get to heaven are rotters. And I may say, that gives me and you some chance.
Now, when you understand Saul come Paul properly, you also see that sincerity is not enough. But many Australians think that it doesn't really matter what you believe, provided you're sincere about your beliefs. That, you know, there's all kinds of different ways to God, and different people have each their own way, and what you believe about God, really, the content of your understanding of God, that's not important. What is important is that you genuinely try, that you really are sincere, that you try to live the life that you see. And if you are sincere enough, then everything else is all right. Well, when you understand Paul and his conversion, he drives a tank right through the side of that argument. Makes nonsense of it in terms of Christianity. That has not anything to do with being Christian. Well, let's look at this man. To understand his conversion, you've got to understand his background first. And I'll put that under the Jewish name Saul. And I'll look quickly at his pedigree and his degree and the practice. So as to fill in some details about this man, you really need to understand that to see the radical nature of his conversion. Saul is known to us both in and outside the New Testament. Indeed, the first Christian writing outside the New Testament, written by the Bishop of Rome, called Clement, to Corinth, makes in AD 96, makes references to Paul and his life and his martyrdom. And he is commonly known of outside the New Testament, but I'm just preserving all the facts today and the information from the documents that you do find bound up together in the New Testament. You find that Saul came from a place called Tarsus, which is a town in southern Turkey, as we would call it. It was a city of great importance and learning, and Saul came from a family that was of a Roman citizenship. Which is something citizenship we take for granted, but not in the ancient world. Very few members of the empire were citizens, and it was a great privilege to be a citizen. It gave you rights. The kinds of rights that you and I enjoy and take for granted were only reserved for people who are citizens. And Saul was certainly a citizen from a citizen family. And most likely were tent makers, seeing he was a tent maker, and most of the children learnt their father's trade. But what is striking about Saul being a citizen in some ways is that he came from a Jewish family. And while he is a Roman citizen, and he uses his citizenship from time to time, and he is proud of it and pleased to have it, Saul thinks of himself fundamentally as a Jew. His own self-consciousness is that of being a Jewish person. In one of the letters he writes to a Greek church in Philippi, he says, "I was circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law, a Pharisee. As for zeal, persecuting the church, as for legalistic righteousness, faultless. I was a Hebrew of the Hebrews, of the tribe of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin. I was circumcised on the eighth day. All that you could expect to be Jewish, I was. What you do to become Jewish, you circumcise. When should you be circumcised? 8 days after your birth. That's when he was circumcised. He was of the tribe, which in some ways is the noblest of the tribe of Benjamin. They were the ones who stuck it with Judah. They were important people, and he was named after the first king of Israel, presumably, who was also a Benjaminite, the only king of Israel who didn't come from the tribe of Judah, the only one therefore that came from the tribe of Benjamin was King Saul, and that is the man, presumably, he is named after. And his family were committedly Jewish people. They spoke Hebrew. And so Saul is a Hebrew-speaking Jew. Many of the Jews who lived outside Palestine, as his family did, gave up speaking Hebrew. They would speak Greek, or they'd speak the language of the community they're living amongst. But Saul's family were devoutly Jewish, and they continued to speak as a Hebrew speaker. He comes from that kind of family, and his family is true blue Jew, because it's Israelite in both sides of the family. He's an Israelite, born of Israelites. See, fundamentally, in understanding himself, is he is Jewish. And therefore, when it comes to his degree and education, he is sent to Jerusalem for his education. Set back home to the true place of education, and sits there in the Pharisaic schools, especially under the school of Gamaliel. It would seem likely that he spent most of his youth in Jerusalem, in education. And Gamaliel, his teacher, was one of the great rabbis and teachers of the first century, known to us in Jewish writings as well as in Christian writings, and a very famous teacher, of whom one of the Jewish writings say that he had a dropout of a student, who's left unnamed, but there is good grounds for believing that this famous dropout was none other than the man Saul of whom we look today, because he certainly was a dropout from Gamaliel's school. he came into the school of Pharisaism in his teaching. And when you get your education in Pharisaism, you are really learning something to practice, not something just to learn and get degrees in. We get degrees in all kinds of things. I've got a degree in geography. It's a fascinating thing to have a degree in. It's so utterly useless. It's magnificent, really. All of you who share with me in the joys of having the experience of the arts faculty know what it is to be educated just for education's sake, or at least to fill in the years till you work out something better to do. And geography is almost the quintessence of that. There are some others that are like it, but I won't insult any more than I've already insulted. And you're not supposed to do anything once you've got a degree in geography, are you? Very few people are employed as geographers anywhere. I've actually had the joy of being employed as a geographer, but no one knew what I was doing at the time, because it was the public service. Now, Pharisaism, there was nothing like that. You can't just learn Pharisaism as an academic, remote, detached kind of nothing. Pharisaism called upon you to commit yourself wholeheartedly to a view of life. And that is the school's rabbinic arguments in which Paul learnt, and indeed did very well in his own scholarship. We know his great scholarship because you see it in his writings. He understood rabbinic thought form and argument and logic very well. He knew the arguments of the scholars of his own people. And not only that, he had such profundity of writing that he really turns many of their arguments on their head and produces a whole new approach to Israel and to Judaism. No two ways about that. Now, whether that is because he has learnt it from Christianity or whether it has come out of the fertility of his own mind, we do not know, but he certainly expresses in rabbinic thought form new and radical views of life and the purpose of God, which he claims, of course, are authentic to Christianity and a true expression of Israel. He is well versed in this rabbinic thought. But being a Pharisee meant that he was passionately concerned for living it out. And what it is that they're concerned for living out is the righteousness of God. Passionately concerned to live in bringing glory and honor to God by the obedience of the law. Because if a man obeyed the law properly, then he would be truly righteous, and Israel would clearly be established as the people of God. And so the Pharisee gave themselves wholeheartedly to the observance of the law. Now, just to kind of illustrate it to you, you can do this from hundreds of different laws. Let me kind of share with you one of the Pharisaic rules, so that you'll get the drift of what they did. It wasn't just a rule, it was a practice. The law said that you were to give a tenth of all your produce, indeed the first tenth of your produce each year, in tax to the temple. The Pharisee took that law and obeyed it, or tried to, and he would take a tenth of all his produce, including his herb garden. He'd go out to the window box, chase through all his mint plants and his parsley plants, and get one tenth of each of them, and he would give that in as well as part of being taxed. So careful was he to observe the whole law and the letter of the law, that he would even go to the details of taxing himself on his window box. Now, I don't know any Australian who observes the taxation laws of Australia with such care. In fact, you're hard-pressed to find any Australian who observes them at all. But to go to those extremes show that the fanaticism the Pharisee has about law-keeping and about the righteousness of God. And the Pharisee was looking forward to the coming of the Messiah, or the Christ. Christ is the Greek word, Messiah is the Hebrew word. Both of them have just been pronounced with a broad Australian accent. And they were looking forward to this coming King, this Messiah, this Christ, who would establish God's rule on earth. He would be established, of course, but it would be established so firmly there that it would spread out to the whole world. And when God's King was ruling over the whole world, he would be ruling in righteousness. He would be ruling by the law of God. And so the whole world would come under this rule of God, under this law of God, and the Messiah would bring it about. But Saul had a problem. There are a group of people that arrived on the scene who said that the Messiah had come already. And they said that the Messiah was some little hick bloke who was executed as a criminal. He hadn't been to the rabbinic school. He hadn't sat at the feet of Gamaliel or anything like that. He was a self-taught nobody, an amateur in the religious field, who had come from that backwood and backwater of the Palestinian life called Nazareth, up there in Galilee. A bit like saying that he came from Queensland. Now, this one, you see, out of this backwoods and nowhere, who was executed as a criminal by the pagans who ran the country. These people were saying that the King of God came to establish the rule of righteousness over the whole earth with Israel as its capital. That was nonsense as far as Saul could see. But what really galled him was the fact that the people who said it were all Jewish. Not only all Jewish, some of them used to be Pharisees. Some of them were priests up at the temple. Leaders and prominent people in the community of Israel, all kinds of Jewish people, started saying the Messiah was not yet to come to establish this world kingdom, but had already come and had already established it. And that the temple, and that righteousness from the law, and Pharisaism, and the whole institutions of Israel, as Saul understood them, had now all become redundant. They were no longer where the scene was at. The scene was all at this executed criminal. Saul and his fellow Pharisees could not tolerate it, for all they held dear was undermined by this group called the Nazarenes, called the Way, whom we know as Christians. And so Saul and his friends led a great persecution on them. The first one who was ever killed was Stephen, who was stoned to death. We've read of stonings recently in the Middle East, and it's a terrible way to execute somebody because it is so slow, especially if they can duck well. Saul was there at the execution of that man. He held the coats while the chief witnesses threw the stones. But Saul, a young man, was so zealous in learning that he was actually given great responsibilities within the Pharisaic community to seek out Christians. And we read in the book of Acts that Saul began to destroy the church, going from house to house. He dragged off men and women and put them in prison. It became a great passion for Saul to do away with Christians. And we read later that Saul was still breathing out murderous thoughts against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priest and asked him for a letter to the synagogues in Damascus, which is the capital of Syria, the neighbouring state, so that if he found any there who belonged to the Way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. Here was Saul's commission. Go to Damascus and even drag out the Christians from there. In our modern tolerant world, it sounds fairly terrible that a man should take his religion so seriously as to be executing his opponents. But within Israel, there was no chance that they could continue the way they had always been and had the Nazarenes at the same time. For all that the Nazarenes were saying destroyed the old Israel. And Saul could not tolerate that as a servant of God of Israel. So, he went to Damascus. Now, it is on Damascus that he has this staggering confrontation. A vision takes place on the road to Damascus. And a vision which changed and transformed civilization as we know it. What happened to this man on this road on this occasion has changed the history of the world. In 1749, another man went on a road, this time leaving Paris. It was a summer's day, and he had a vision. His name was Rousseau, and his vision was quite a staggering one, really. It, too, has changed the course of human civilization. I share it with you, partly so as to show how a single person's vision can have a tremendous, profound effect on civilization, so as to perceive that what Paul saw also will have a tremendous effect on civilization, but partly too because Rousseau's vision is the exact antithesis of Saul. Rousseau, when he was on the road, saw something new, a radical new thought that had come to him that he'd never had before. That is that men, and I presume you meant by that women, men are basically good. And the thing that is evil in the world are the systems, the structures, the societies in which men live. But we are by nature, naturally, basically, good beings, and our systems are rotten. 1749. Out of that vision and the teaching of Rousseau that followed from it, you see the rise of the Enlightenment movement, so-called. I call it the Endarkenment, but you can't find it in the encyclopedias under that. You guys will look up Enlightenment. You see the Enlightenment period, and the whole doctrine that lies behind, say, the French Revolution of 1789. liberty, fraternity, equality, see, come out of the idea that men are basically good. And if we could free men from the institutions and from the oppressive regime that they are living under, then out of their goodness they'll create a good new society. You can see and trace without any great difficulty the effect that the French Revolution and the Enlightenment thinking has upon Karl Marx, whose family experienced some of the pleasures of that brief liberation from Jewish persecution. It was prior to the time that their family became Christian. But it was through the French Revolution that they experienced that, through the benefit of the Enlightenment. And Marx, right throughout his ideas, never really varies much from that concept that people are basically good, that the system is basically rotten, and that the system needs to be, well, torn down, ripped up and thrown away. Because the system is the oppressive thing of people who in themselves are quite good. Anything that has affected Marxism has certainly upset the apple cart in terms of world history, hasn't it? And foundational to thinking has got to do with Rousseau. Or again, in education theory. I don't know what it's like in the Department of Education at this university, but all the radical educationists, the great Rousseauists, when you check them out, they believe kids are really good. Kids are by nature inquisitive, inquiring minds. If you just let them go, they would find out lots of things. They would learn, they would educate themselves. All you need to do is just stand by so that when they want to ask a question, you're there to answer it. Because really, the child is good. And the thing that inhibits his goodness and destroys his inquisitiveness is the system, is the institution, the structures. You said that poor, unfortunate people here in the social work faculty. It's the basis of all that you're doing down there is Rousseauism. It's all got to do with it. That what you need to do is alter the system. People don't have real problems. The structures have the problems. The society needs to be changed to help people who are basically good, but who have been oppressed and put into difficult situations. And so it goes on. Rousseau's had a profound effect on people's thinking in our society. In fact, most of you think like Rousseau without ever having checked out anything about the man. Saul has a vision. His vision's not an intellectual abstract like that. His vision's a very real physical vision. But his vision has the same impact, if not greater impact, on civilization. And his vision is radically different to the vision of Rousseau, indeed an antithesis to it. For in the middle of his campaign, as he goes up to Damascus, suddenly there is a great blinding light from heaven, and a voice speaks to him, and he sees somebody. With whom does he come in contact and confrontation at that point? He says, the voice from heaven says, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And Saul says, who are you, Lord? And the voice from heaven says, I am Jesus, whom you persecute. I don't know how that happens. I've never had a vision. I've never heard a voice from heaven. And if I did, I'd be deeply disturbed about the whole experience. In the opera house the other night, and voices from heaven came there. Suddenly, just before the program started, a voice boomed out, saying, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry that the program has been altered and this is not going to happen. And I looked around, I couldn't see a person speaking anywhere. Gives you the fair creeps, it does. They can see me, I can't see them. They can talk to me, I can't talk to them. But generally speaking, I don't have voices coming from heaven. I don't have writings on the walls, I don't have blinding lights, I don't. None of those kinds of things have happened to me. I don't understand how they happen. I don't understand whether they were using ever-ready torch batteries or they had a power source. I don't understand the mechanics of it. But I know that the New Testament writers and Paul himself were persuaded that it not only happened, but it had a profound effect on their experience of life. Saul repeatedly makes reference to the vision experience that he has on the road to Damascus. It obviously changed and transformed him, whatever happened out there on that road. He is a new and different man when he comes in off the road from Damascus. Nothing in the life of Saul is ever the same again. And the Christians who know Saul know the same thing because they constantly are referring to the way in which he had this experience on the road to Damascus. And he says the experience was that of being blinded by the light and having spoken to Jesus, not a ghost, not a phantom, but to the Jesus who had risen from the dead. He is led into Damascus blind. And for 3 days they put him up in a pub and he sits there in total blackness. No friends, no nothing. I reckon they would have been the 3 longest days in his life. But I also reckon that I can work out what was the first thing he thought for himself. I reckon most likely the first thing, if I was in his situation, I would have worked out. First thing is, I'm good. The one that I'm trying to persecute and execute actually has turned out to be God. I think you would get the drift of being good, don't you? I mean, you couldn't actually be much further wrong, could you? As a possibility, you're hard-pressed to think of a circumstance in life where you could be more wrong than to be actually trying to destroy God's people and then to meet up face-to-face with Him. After 3 days, a man, Ananias, is sent to him. Ananias took a great deal of bravery, of course, to turn up. Ananias is a Christian. This man is a known persecuting Christian. He comes to him and explains to Saul why it was that he had the vision. And he says, God has chosen you for a special task. That is to proclaim the message of Jesus to the ends of the earth. And Saul was the exact person to do it. Not because he was clever. He was clever. And he used his cleverness to do God's work. But that's not the reason. Not because he was a Roman citizen and had freedom of the state and movement around the world. He did do that. And he had those benefits. That wasn't the reason. There are lots of Roman citizens. There are lots of clever people. It wasn't that he was Jewish or that he could speak Greek. No. Saul had something else going for him that nobody else had going for him. He was an exact example of what it is to be a Christian and how it is that you become a Christian. He is a living, walking model of what is a Christian and how you become a Christian. Think about it for a moment. If this man now becomes a Christian, it is quite clear that sincerity and zeal were not enough, were they? Because he's been sincere and zealous all the way along the line. He sincerely was persecuting the Christians. He zealously was persecuting them. He really believed in what he believed in. But he was wrong. He has now discovered he was totally and completely and utterly wrong. Although completely zealous. It's not sufficient to be sincere and to be zealous. You've got to be sincere about the right thing and zealous about the right thing. Again, if you know more reflection, that's obvious, really, when you ponder it. I mean, there's a lot of nonsense, this relativistic sincerity business. You see, I can be as sincere as I like, but no matter how firmly I believe, no matter how zealously and passionately I'm committed to the view that the world's a cube, that doesn't make it one, does it? I mean, if you're wrong, you're wrong. And your degree of sincerity is an irrelevance to whether you ever become right. Got nothing to do with that, has it? And there's more to it than that. We've all been sincerely wrong at certain times, haven't we? I certainly have, and I know I have. You may not know that you have yet, but we all have. You can look back at your life and say, I used to believe that. I now know that's wrong. But when I used to believe that, I was sincere. I really did believe it. It just happens that it was wrong. And you say, well, Philip, you're talking about physical, empirical things like world being round or cubed or something like that. Well, here we're talking about values. You've got two problems about that. One is, it's not just about values. Jesus has risen from the dead, or he hasn't risen from the dead. Just like the world, it either is a cube, or it's not a cube. It can't be both a cube and not a cube at the same time. Jesus can't be both dead and risen at the same time. He either is or is not dead. He either is or has not risen. The same kind of deal we're dealing with, not just values. But even with values, you can't really. I mean, I take it that Hitler was sincere. Hitler was zealous and sincere. But I hope no one here wants to argue that he was right. That's not to suggest that he was left. Don't want to argue that he was right and correct. Sincerely wrong is a possibility that we mustn't rule out. And Paul, you see, drives a whole tank right through the idea that Christianity doesn't matter what you believe, provided you're sincere. Absolute nonsense, that one. But more. You see, Saul demonstrates what a Christian is and what he's not. Think about it. A Christian is not a religious person, is it? Because Saul was as religious as they come. He was in rabbinic training. He was training to be a religious professional. If he hadn't even reached that stage, he may have reached it. But he certainly was training. He was a zealously committed religious personage. And he wasn't a Christian. You can be as religious as the cows, but you're not a Christian. No relevance. Or moral. See, Saul was a moral man, he says, under the law of God, I was faultless. He wasn't a murderer. He didn't steal. He didn't commit adultery. He honoured his father and mother. He kept the Sabbath day. He was more religious and more moral than most people in our community have ever thought of being. And yet, he wasn't a Christian. You see, Saul actually starts to spell out for us, what is the nature of Christianity and how you become it. He is a model of it. And that is why he is chosen by God to be the representative of Christianity throughout the world. And that is why he's like a lens that focuses the issues with such clarity that people can perceive what genuine Christianity really is and how you become one. For what has happened to Paul?
He has been turned around. That's what happened to him.
Completely and radically turned around. We read in the story in Damascus. For after a while he was baptized and he began to preach in the synagogues that Jesus was the Son of God, and all those who heard him were astonished. Reckon they were. They said, isn't this the man who raised havoc in Jerusalem among those who call on the name of Jesus? And hasn't he come here to take them prisoners of the chief priests? Yet Saul grew more and more powerful and baffled the Jews living in Damascus by proving that Jesus is the Messiah. We read as he writes to a group of Christians in a place called Galatia, which is northern Turkey, I understand. He writes this about the Christians down in Jerusalem. He says, they don't know about me. They only heard the report that the man who formerly persecuted us is now preaching the faith that he once tried to destroy. Something radical has happened. This man has completely turned around. He is the way. Completely different. In the exact opposite direction. Friends, it's one of the great problems for those who do not want to accept Christianity as to how do you explain the existence of Christians. It's a terrible problem, really, for those who want to be at least truthful and honest and sincere in their inquiry and yet dispense with Christianity. How do you cope with the fact that a Jewish man like Saul, who is contentedly and happily Jewish and Pharisaic and religious, how can you cope with the fact that this man suddenly throws in all that to take on a course which leads him to being bashed and knocked about Damascus and is let down with a basket down over the wall because they wanted to kill him? How do you cope? How do you explain the fact that in AD 64, only what, 30 years after the death of Jesus, there are so many Christians in Rome and they are so well hated that Nero is able to blame them for the burning of Rome? Only 30 years after Jesus had died in absolute obscurity in the backwater of the empire. Only 30 years later, they are in sufficient number in the centre of the empire to be able to be known by the emperor and blamed by the emperor and the populace to accept the blame because they are so disliked. What happened that transformed the ancient world like that? What took place? Saul tells you, he says, I met Jesus. I used to believe Jesus was a common criminal executed and well and good got rid of, and hoped that I could get rid of his followers too. But I was out there in the road and I met him. He's not dead. He's alive. And he has risen to be the ruler of the world. He is the Messiah who brings true righteousness and the rule of God into the whole world. See, what is it that explains Paul, or could ever explain Paul, what has caused this change? He didn't have a new thought, like Rousseau, and say, oh, well, let's think of a new philosophy at the start, and come out with a great thought. He didn't go into deep pondering of an idea, like Descartes, who climbed into an oven, so I understand, and came out saying, I think, therefore I am. He doesn't come to any great philosophical speculation like that. I would have thought he'd turn the oven down, it's getting too hot, but I think I am who I am, is what he came out saying. Maybe it shows his brains were boils. Now, he didn't come out like that. He says, I saw the man, the executed one, risen as the ruler of the world. That is the thing that has caused the change. But you ponder it for a moment, because once you see that, then everything else in life must radically change. Nothing can be the same. Everything Saul understood about what the Old Testament was about, what Israel was about, what life was about, what death and heaven and hell, there was no thought that he had ever had before which could now stand unchecked. Every thought had to be rechecked because he was so fundamentally and completely in error in his whole appreciation and perception of life. The whole thing is changed. Look, Saul was like a good sailor. You and I are good sailors. I don't know whether you like being a sailor or not, but let me put you down as a sailor for a little while. We're all good sailors. Of course we're good ones. And we like to be good. We're helpful to our crew, aren't we? We always take our watch. We're never late for our watch. We always We always keep awake at watch. We look after the cargo whenever we're on a cargo trip and make sure that it's not damaged in any way. If one of our fellow crewmen is sick, we look after them. We'll go and care for them, provide the meal for them, stand watch for them if need be, write to their relatives, or whatever it may be. If we're involved in military action at sea, then we stand to our post and we don't run away in cowardice. We are good sailors, like Saul was a good sailor. A commendable sailor. No black mark against his record. One day, though, in sailing the ship, he looks up to the masthead, and he sees on the top of the masthead, for the first time ever, something he failed to notice before. But the ship he was flying, the ship he was sailing on, was actually flying the skull and crossbones. Now, once you perceive that fact, that one little fact that you had missed previously, once you discover that fact, then every other fact you've ever had is wrong, isn't it? The whole of your life now has to be rewritten. All your evaluation of your actions has shown to be inaccurate. And the better you were a sailor, the worse you were in fact, because the more you are advocating piracy. The more you contributed to the welfare of the ship, the more you contributed to the welfare of the rebellion against the government. Now you can be saying that I was doing good things. Of course you were doing good things, but they were rotten, weren't they? Because you were heading the wrong direction. You were on the wrong side. You were actually in the enemy. You were in the rebellion. No matter whether it was good, bad, or indifferent. In fact, if you were a rotten person in the rebellion, you might have been doing the cause of the true government a lot of good. It's because you were so good that you caused the rebellion to succeed so well. Now you see what Paul sees? And remember, I said you're all sailors. Because the nature of Christianity is to say that is the state of man. We're all flying under the rebellion, under the cross, under the skull. I can't say this one right, but the skull bones and the we're all flying under that flag of rebellion. That is the nature of it. And the better we are, the more moral we are, the more upright we are, the more we're actually in rebellion against the idea that Jesus is the one who's in charge, that Jesus' government is the one we should live under. That is an intolerable thing for us. Jesus does not come, he says, to call the righteous people, but sinners to repentance. Saul sees Jesus and he realizes not only his old view of the Old Testament and Israel and all those things are wrong, his view of himself is wrong. But he thought he was right. He thought he was moral. He thought he was religious. He thought he was okay with God. But he now sees that he was in total and absolute rebellion against God. He had God in his box. And now on the road to Damascus, he realizes that God actually doesn't give him box at all. He had totally mistaken God and God's righteousness. That's a staggering thing. In the notes, I've actually addressed the next two questions, pardon and righteousness. Following me. Because now he discovers that his righteousness is a completely different thing. In that passage I read in Philippians, you see, he used to say, I had everything going for me. Under the law, I was righteous. Legalistic righteousness, I was faultless. I had everything going for me, but then he goes on to say, yet now that I've discovered Christ, I consider everything as loss compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Jesus my Lord, for whose sake I've lost all things, and I consider them as rubbish, that I may gain Christ. All his previous righteousness, his religiosity, his morality, his everything, he says is rubbish. In fact, the English versions are too polite at this point. He actually calls them sewerage. That which you send down the toilet. I am also too polite to say the word that he uses at this point. We're all euphemistic at this point. He wasn't euphemistic. He says, that is what it is worth. It is awful. It is dung. It is that which is sewerage. All my religion. All my righteousness. All my Israel background. My circumcision on the safe day. And my everything that I had going for me. It's not worth a thing. Because I've now got a different kind of righteousness, a righteousness that comes from God. Friends, this is extraordinary. Right? This is as radical as actually meeting Jesus, this whole concept. You see, you and I, if we think of God and our relationship with him at all, think of righteousness in terms of how we pull ourselves up by our shoestrings. And we say, well, are you righteous enough for God? And say, well, I kind of hope I am. You know, I mean, I'm better than the lady next to me. who is also thinking, I'm better than the blokes sitting next to me. That, of course, is one of those stupid thoughts that has ever crossed the minds of every person sitting in this room, because what you're really saying is, I, a dwarf, am taller than the dwarf sitting next to me. Of course, both of us are unrighteous. It's just that I'm a little less unrighteous than he's unrighteous. You say, well, I hope that I'm all right with God because, you know, I try and do the right thing. I can only say I hope I am, because if I say, yes, I am righteous, then I'm proud, aren't I? And I've just bombed out. And so I say, I hope I am kind of, which of course is a lie, because I actually believe I am all right with God. Because I've just lied about it, I also bombed out. So either way, you're a goner on that question, aren't you, as to whether you're right enough before God. You can never be sure you're right enough before God. And when someone says, I know I'm going to heaven, you say, oh, he's a bit proud, he's a bit arrogant. Well, now, friends, let me tell you something. Paul and I know of a certainty that both Paul and I are going to heaven. Yeah? Proud, arrogant? Well, you knew that all along, didn't you? No, no, nothing to do with pride and arrogance. That's not... Because the righteousness that we've got is not the righteousness that comes from pulling yourself up by your shoestrings. The righteousness that we've got is the righteousness that comes from God, who pardons you completely. God says, you're innocent in my sight. You're right with me. It's not right because I'm actually righteous. No, I'm a rotter. I'm a wretch. It's righteous because God has declared me righteous. How can that be? That is what Paul discovers out in the great road to Jesus. He discovers pardon. He discovers the true way to righteousness is not by achievement, but by forgiveness. It's not the good who go to heaven, it's the forgiven. And to be forgiven, you've got to be rotten to start with. I've done my bit of rottenness, let me assure you. Forgiveness is all that is needed from here on in. That is the true nature of righteousness. You see, in 1 Timothy, it's a book that Paul writes to his young friend Timothy towards the end of his life. He says these things. Here is a trustworthy saying that deserves full acceptance. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the chief. He hadn't met Philip Jensen, of course, at that time. Of whom I am the chief. But for that very reason, I was shown mercy so that in me, the chief of sinners, Christ Jesus might display his unlimited patience as an example for those who would believe on him and receive eternal life. If God can forgive the chief sinner, then he can certainly forgive the little Indian sinners. And you cannot be a greater sinner than to set your whole life's ambition on the execution of God's people. He's got good claim to be the chief sinner, hasn't he? He is a perfect expression of utter rebelliousness against God and God's Messiah. He is it, because that's what he's given his life to. And God is able to forgive him. How can God forgive him? Well, by the nature of the Messiah. For it's a true saying, and worthy we receive, he says, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners. See, Jesus did not come in to show us how to live. He didn't come in to love us, in the sense of showing us that he can pat little children on the head of all the different nations and give us some of those Sunday school pictures. Jesus hasn't come for that. Jesus came into the world to die for sinners. Jesus was born a corpse. He was born to be executed, not to be a gurgling baby to give presents for a while. He was born to be done for. Why? Because he dies in our place. He takes my punishment, your punishment, upon himself. He is executed in my place. I deserve to be executed. He doesn't deserve to be executed. But he goes to the execution under the name of Philip Jensen. He actually takes my place and my wrath for me. He comes into the world to rescue rotters. If you're not a rotter, Jesus has got nothing to do with you. Of course you are. Therefore, Jesus has got everything to do with you because he's actually taken the rap for you if you'll only face up to the rottenness of your life. Paul, you see, thought he wasn't a rotten man. He was a good man, religious man, moral man. That's like most Australians think they're like that. Until one day he comes face to face with Jesus and then he realizes that the government is right. The system is right. What's wrong is not the system. No, but I don't want to have someone running my life. I want to do my own thing, my own way. But once I face up to the fact that Jesus is the Lord of heaven and earth, he's not dead, he's the ruler of the universe, I can't anymore live the same way, can I? I can't go on and say, oh, you're not going to do my own thing. That's stupidity. If he's the king of the universe, the earth, the ruler and the judge, then he must be mine as well. So you see, Saul actually highlights for us what is a Christian and how you become one, which is the last things on the note there. It's just a matter of tying the strings together. For he sets out what it is not. I'm sorry, I've said the point before. But it's so crucial, I'll give it to you again. It is not morality. It is not religion. It is not sincerity. It is not zeal. It is not mystical absorption up into something or other. It is not prayer. It is not obeying the Ten Commandments. I mean, if it was all about obeying the Ten Commandments, Saul didn't have to. He was already doing that, wasn't he? In case you hadn't noticed, the Ten Commandments are Jewish. No reason for a Jew ever to become a Christian if Christianity is obeying the Ten Commandments. There's every reason for Christians becoming Jewish if that were the case. It is not that, whatever else it is. See, Saul sets out what it is not, and nearly everything everybody ever believed it was, Saul shows it wasn't. Nearly everything. All the cherished ideas of what Christianity may be, Saul the convert makes nonsense of. And he also shows how you don't become a Christian. See, how it is not done. It's not by being baptized. It's not by being circumcised. It's not by belonging to a religious family. It's not like turning over a new leaf. It's not by becoming more religious somehow, or more moral, or trying hard. That's not how you become a Christian. What is a Christian then? Christian is one who recognizes that Jesus has risen from the dead and is alive as the Lord of heaven and earth, the ruler of heaven and earth. And therefore, has Jesus as their own ruler, their own Lord. So I can cut it down short and say, the Christian is one who recognizes Jesus as their Lord, as their master. Who lives under Jesus' government rather than their own or anybody else's. That is a Christian person. And therefore, as they do that, they will be rescued by this Jesus who died on their behalf and rose again to establish God's kingdom on earth. There is the Christian, the one who lives under the rule of Jesus, who has that relationship with Jesus as their king, that you may never have seen him on the road to Damascus. You may never have cut your eyes on Jesus. Few people I know, in fact, no one have either known has ever done that. But you can find out whether Jesus rose from the dead without doing that. By looking into the history books, by examining the evidences and weighing up the arguments. Many, many people become Christians without any reason for doing so. They don't know why they believe Jesus rose from the dead. They just do. That's a bit silly. Many people reject Christianity without ever knowing the reasons. They don't know who Jesus was, and if they do have an idea, when you ask them, how do you know, they say, oh, I don't know, I just think that's the way it is. That is no way to do history. You need to go and look at the evidence, look at the documents to see who Jesus was. But if you've come persuaded, as I have been, and as Paul and as thousands of Christians throughout the centuries have been, that Jesus is not dead, but alive and ruling the universe, then you can no longer live the same life. You must have a radical change that turns your head, because every other piece of information in your life suddenly is radically transformed. The whole life becomes different. So how do you become a Christian? By acknowledging Jesus. If my prayer is Jesus' way, and she confesses, say, God, I'm sorry, I've not lived your way. I perceive that Jesus is the risen Lord, and I ask for forgiveness. And I want you, Jesus, to run my life. And he said that if you start living it. But it's that relationship you enter into with Jesus as your Lord. Down on the front counter here, there's some little booklets I've got in two piles here, and I'm very happy for people if they'd like to take one. It's called What is a Christian? If what I've said today has actually unsettled you at all in the slightest about what is a Christian, or if you knew already that you didn't know too much about what is a Christian, or how you become a Christian, or if you just like to find out more about it, I'm happy for you to take one of those on the way out, so that you may read it. But it really has to come back to my understanding of who Jesus is. In the late 1960s, Malcolm Muggeridge, who was an ex-editor of Punch, a great anti-Christian man, and a very reluctant man about Christianity, was making for the BBC a series of films on Jesus. And on Easter morning, he walked along the road to Emmaus, where Jesus is said to have first appeared to his disciples. And Malcolm Muggeridge, who was then quite considerable age, said that as he walked on the road to Emmaus, he became aware of the fact that he was not alone. That there was one who had walked this road before, who was walking with him then. And Malcolm Muggeridge, persuaded that Jesus had risen from the dead, changed his whole life. Nothing in Malcolm Muggeridge's life was ever the same again. A journalistic career, popular, being the man who at that time was director of the University Chancellor of the University of Edinburgh. Within 12 months, he had to resign more than a year before he had to resign that in protest by the student action because his whole life, nothing was ever the same again. What Paul decided, Malcolm Muggeridge art of loving him or putting on his heart. You can know to be true by the evidences that are available to us. Once you perceive it to be true, you can never be the same again.
Thank you, Father, for the opportunity of thinking again about this man who so demonstrates the nature of Christianity. We thank you for choosing him to do that for us. We thank you for the great news. It doesn't matter how rotten you may have ever been, you can know forgiveness because your Son came not for those who are righteous, but for those who are sinners. We pray for each one of us, Father, that we might earnestly and honestly and sincerely pursue the truth. And having found the truth wherever it may lead us, that we might have the integrity to live by. We ask you.